Du lytter til Radio 24/7,
fordi det er den helt originale taleradio.
Velkommen til Aflyttet med Anders Kjærulf.
Velkommen til et program, der er iført skæg og blå briller, i hvert fald indeni, hvor vi i dag har helliget det hele til en mand, der har meget delte meninger om. Han hedder Richard Stallman, hans fulde navn er Richard Matthew Stallman. Han blev også kaldt RMS efter sin første brugernavn på den computer, han brugte på Harvard Universitetet. Blandt computerkyndige, der er Stallman kendt for softwareprojektet og styresystemet GNU, GNU not Unix, en bunke fri og åben software, der udgør et gratis styresystem for de, der har evner til at få det til at fungere. Den 62-årige Stallman, han har været en stejl fortaler for netop fri og åben software i modsætning til Microsoft og Apples copyright-styrede udvikling, og så er han aktivist, der mener, vores computer forråder os med mere og mere overvågning. Stallman taler gerne og længe, og her i foråret, der var han i Danmark for at tale ved Klikfestivalen i Helsingør. Jeg vil gerne have haft et interview med ham på stedet, men den ekscentriske programmør havde så mange sære betingelser for, hvornår det skulle være, at det viste sig at være nemmere at ringe til ham i stedet. Selvom det heller ikke var helt nemt. Han har nemlig ingen telefon, han nægter at få en og giver i stedet journalister numrene på de mennesker, han bor hos, så denne gang startede det med en samtale med en for mig ukendt dame i Spanien.
I'm searching for... Hello? Hello? Do you speak English?
Yes.
I'm sorry. I hope I got the right number. I'm searching for a Mr. Stallman.
I give it to you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Hello, this is Richard Stallman.
Hello, Richard Stallman. This is Anna from Denmark.
A
Danish journalist who've been trying to reach.
That's good. Yeah, I know. You're the only person I suggested should phone me here today. Have you got equipment to make a recording?
Yes, and it's already running.
That's good.
Yeah.
So, let's start.
We'll do that. First of all, Mr. Stallman, the world becomes increasingly interconnected. The internet is everywhere and is at everybody's fingertips through their phones. Do you see this
as... Not everybody's.
No.
Some of us refuse.
You don't use a phone.
I don't carry a portable phone.
Okay.
I've never had one. And that's for a very specific reason, because they are Stalin's dream. They track people, and they can be remotely converted into listening devices. This is well documented. I can provide you references for it. So, basically, if Stalin could have given everyone in the Soviet Union a device to carry that would say where the person was and would listen, if desired, to that person's conversations, that would tell Stalin's men who knows whom, because their phones would be visibly, they would be tracked to the same place. Stalin would have done that. But fortunately for the Soviet Union, that technology did not exist in Stalin's day. It exists today, and people have been induced to carry these things. We know, thanks to leaks, that the NSA can tell that two people know each other because it sees that their portable phones are close together in the same place, basically. Well, it's my duty as a citizen to refuse to carry such a thing, and I do my duty.
Richard Stallman har ikke nogen mobiltelefon. Han har aldrig haft en, og han får aldrig nogen. Mobiltelefoner, det er Stalins våde drøm, hævder han. Deres lokation kan spores, og så kan man skabe dem om til rummikrofoner, der kan aflytte en hele tiden. Vi er blevet lokket til at gå med mobiltelefoner konstant, men de bliver brugt til at holde øje med os, og vi skal bare være glade for, at de ikke fandtes dengang Stalin levede, for så ville Sovjetunionen stadigvæk eksistere og sandsynligvis styre hele verden, hævder altså en veloplagt Richard Stallman, der understreger, at han ser det som en borgerpligt at holde fingrene fra mobiltelefoner. Og jeg er en god borger, siger han. Men hvordan klarer man sig uden en telefon i en moderne verden?
How do you come about this duty in your daily life? Most people would have a lot of problems not having a mobile phone.
I don't find it a problem. After all, 20 years ago, most people didn't have mobile phones, and somehow they got through their days. And they didn't all say, damn, I wish I had something here that was tracking me.
So how do we come about if we should kind of get rid of this tracking device? Are there any kind of, what do you think, what kind of policy should we engage in?
Well, what we really need is a policy. Well, first of all, the level of surveillance that we are subject to is incompatible with democracy. It's not just the annoyance that companies might figure out something about you. That's a secondary issue. Yeah, that might be annoying, but really, what could they do to me? What's really dangerous is that the government can get this data. The government doesn't directly collect it. It's companies that collect it, but the government can get it. Once the government gets it, it can identify dissidents. It can tell which dissidents know other dissidents. It can identify whistleblowers. The U.S. has imprisoned whistleblowers, people who told Americans and the world about wrongdoing by the U.S. government, has put some in prison after identifying them through phone call records. Well, basically what this means is that democracy is in danger. In order for the people to control what the government does, the people have to know what the government does. But the government keeps things secret. How do we find out? Thanks to whistleblowers. But the government calls the whistleblowers criminals, and if it can find them, it will put them in prison. Well, that means we have to make sure the government can't identify who is the whistleblower. In other words, can't identify who is the journalist's source. Well, total surveillance of communications and movements of people enables the government to identify the sources. Thus, democracy is in danger. We have to insist on redesigning systems so that they don't store data about the movements and communications and actions of people in general, and in particular, not of journalists and not of everybody who works for the government.
Det er ikke noget problem for mig at undvære en mobil. Tænk dig lidt om, for 20 år siden, der var der ingen, der havde mobiler, og det gik faktisk fint, og man hørte ingen af dem gå rundt og sige, øv, altså hvor jeg savner en dims, der overvåger og spionerer mod mig konstant, siger Richard Stallman. Det niveau af overvågning, vi er udsat for, er simpelthen en trussel mod demokratiet, mener Stallman. En ting er firmaerne, der overvåger os, det er en plage, men det betyder ikke så meget. Men når regeringen også har adgang, så har vi problemet. De kan identificere de mennesker, der ikke er enige med dem, og holde øje med alt, de gør. Og de kan fange whistleblowere, der fortæller om det, og sætte dem i fængsel. Dem har vi nogle stykker af i USA, siger Stallman. Folk, der har fortalt om forkerte ting, USA har gjort, de er blevet sat i fængsel på grund af lokning af deres telefoner. Hvordan finder vi ud af, at det sker? Ja, det er kun via whistleblowere, og det er dem, som regeringen kan kriminalisere. Og hvis de kan finde dem, så ryger de i fængsel. Derfor er vi nødt til at beskytte dem og sikre, at journalisters kilder ikke kan afsløres. Vi må insistere på, at systemerne redesignes, så man ikke gemmer elektroniske oplysninger om vores kommunikation sådan helt automatisk, især for journalister, siger altså Stallman. Men hvad så med den frivillige overvågning? Den vi bliver udsat for gennem sociale medier som Twitter, LinkedIn og Facebook. Er det mon tro noget, som Richard Stallman deltager i eller har en løsning på?
Well, I won't use Facebook on principle because Facebook is a tracking system and I'm not willing to be tracked. I present my message through the internet the same way that we all did, say, 15 years ago. I have a website called Stallman.org for my own views about many things, for what I publish and so on. And the the GNU project and the free software movement have a website, GNU.org. The Free Software Foundation has a website, FSF.org. So lots of people see what I say. I don't need to do it through Facebook. Twitter, until about a year ago, was probably okay to use. I think the crucial point is you could use Twitter without identifying yourself to Twitter, which meant that it wasn't a way of tracking for the state to track who talks with whom. But I've heard, I haven't checked into this, that nowadays it's hard to get a Twitter account without identifying yourself, which means that I wouldn't get one. I wouldn't get a Twitter account now. In fact, I never started to use any of those social media because it was inconvenient for me. This was before I started to think about right and wrong of them. It's simply that I'm traveling all the time, and I won't be in contact when I'm on a train or an airplane or in somebody's car, or staying in some place where there is normally no net connection. So I connect to the internet a couple of times a day, and I download my mail as a batch, and then I spend hours reading it and responding, and then in my next connection, I send out the mail. Email works for me because it's asynchronous. I can write the message now, and I can send it in 6 hours or 10 hours. And not only that, I can review all the messages before I send them and rewrite them to make them better, which helps me tremendously. I recommend this to everyone, not to send out emails right away, but save them up and review them all. In any case, I didn't use any of the social media, whether I would consider it ethical or not, because it just wasn't feasible for me. But because this kept me outside of them, I was able to later, subsequently, think about them ethically without being stuck to them. It wasn't a question of deciding to stop using them. I wasn't going to use them for practical reasons. So I could think about what was good or bad about them in an objective way.
Jeg bruger i princippet ikke Facebook. Facebook, det er et overvågningssystem, og jeg er ikke villig til at blive overvåget. Jeg bruger internettet på samme måde, som folk gjorde for 15 år siden. Jeg har et website. Det hedder stallman.org, og der kan jeg få udtryk for mine meninger. Der er masser af mennesker, der læser det, jeg skriver. Det behøver jeg ikke Facebook for at få dem til. Twitter var egentlig fornuftigt indtil for godt et år siden, fordi Twitter ikke vidste, hvem man var, så staten ikke kunne vide, hvem der talte med hvem. I dag skal man identificere sig, og så gider jeg ikke, siger altså Stallman. Stallman har altid rejst meget, og måske er det også derfor, at han ikke har brugt de sociale medier særlig meget. Han er nemlig ikke online hele tiden, så det var ikke praktisk for ham at deltage i det. Nu har han så kunnet studere fænomenet sociale medier lidt på afstand, og han mener altså ikke, at han er gået glip af noget. Han er godt tilfreds med sine hjemmesider og så sin e-mail, som han elsker at opfunde et særligt system til at håndtere. Han henter alle sine mails ned om morgenen, samtidig med at han afsender de mails, han skrev dagen før. Så har han hele dagen til at svare på de nye mails, han har fået, og det virker godt for ham. Jeg kan klart anbefale ikke at svare på mails lige med det samme, men i stedet vente til dagen efter, siger han. Det er godt at tænke sig lidt om, og have tid til at finde et fornuftigt svar på, hvad folk fra hele verden sender mod en.
How about how much does anonymity mean to you on the internet?
Anonymity is tremendously important, not just on the internet, but in life. That's why the extent of tracking that is done now is terribly dangerous. When I connect to the internet, I do not identify myself. That's a principle I've adopted. And I do this because I want to fight for anonymity. If we to fight for anonymity, we've got to insist on it because that keeps us honest. So even though everything I'm going to communicate over the internet will be encrypted, and even if a Big Brother knew that it was me talking to the internet, Big Brother wouldn't be able to see any of the communication. Still, it's wrong for Big Brother to know that I'm in that spot.
Det er helt forkert at staten Big Brother ved hvor jeg er og hvad jeg skriver. Vi har ret til at sige, hvad vi vil, uden at nogen skal vide, hvor vi er henne og hvad vi skriver, og derfor bruger jeg selvfølgelig kryptering, siger altså Stallman, før vi går videre til hans yndlingsemne, fri og åben software. Stallman har arbejdet for, at kildekoden i alle programmer skal være fri og åben, og det har han gjort med en konsekvent og stædighed, der har gjort ham upopulær mange steder. Han har råbt op med om retten til at eje og ændre sine egne programmer siden 80'erne, men hvad er egentlig status lige nu?
Well, free software keeps on advancing in one level and is struggling desperately at another level. People keep developing more free software packages to do more things that used to be impossible to do are gradually becoming feasible and then convenient to do with free software. However, at the level of interfacing to hardware, it's getting more difficult. And the reason is that the hardware manufacturers don't cooperate with us, and they become more and more uncooperative with their own customers. In 1983, when I announced the GNU project, you could expect any computer was sold with manuals telling you everything you needed to know to write an operating system for that machine, to write device controllers for that machine. Of course, ordinary users don't need to know these things, but we need to know these things to develop free operating systems and free drivers. Well, back then, you could assume, and I did assume, that the manufacturers would publish all this, that we wouldn't have any problem except we'd have to do some work. Nowadays, it's normal that the manufacturers refuse to tell the purchasers of the product how to run it. And the particularly nasty manufacturers are going beyond that. They design their product so you can't use it with any software except what they say you're supposed to use, which, of course, is a non-free program. Which means we now have to find the unusual computers that permit getting rid of the non-free software.
Der bliver mere og mere software, der er åben og fri, men vores store modstander i dag er dem, der laver hardwaren, selve computeren. I 1983, da Stallman skrev GNU-manifestet, der kunne man få en manual og et diagram over alle nyere maskiner. Sådan er det ikke i dag. De store firmaer vil ikke samarbejde med andre end deres egne programmører og de store softwarefirmaer, så der er mange moderne computer, man simpelthen ikke kan få fri og åben software til at køre på, fordi man ikke ved, hvordan de virker. Det er en plage, siger Stallman, der oplever, at bevægelsen nu er reduceret til at kunne arbejde på nogle bestemte maskiner. Hvilket det er, det kan vi få lidt at vide om til sidste program, men først skal vi lige have en forklaring på, hvorfor fri og åben software måske er en vej ud af overvågningssamfundet, i hvert fald ifølge Stallman.
How can free software, how can that help us against this increasing surveillance society you're talking about?
Well, first of all, free software does something absolutely essential for users, which is bigger than just resistance to surveillance. Free software is not specifically an anti-surveillance measure, although it can help protect you from some kinds of surveillance. But free software means that the users control the program. With non-free proprietary software, the program controls the users. And the developer or proprietor of the program controls the program. So a non-free program is an instrument of unjust power, typically for some company, over the people who fall into the trap. And it is a trap. So it's absolutely essential to reject non-free software, surveillance or no surveillance. However, it's also worth noting that proprietary software gives you zero security against the developer. You see, people, when they talk about computer security, they tend to have a blind spot. They're implicitly talking about security against third parties, strangers. Well, that counts for something, but they're not the only ones that might attack you through your computer. The developer of the program you're using might attack you through your computer. Now, if you're using a proprietary program, which is totally under the control of that one company, that means you are at that company's mercy. You are defenseless. And it's now normal for companies to put malicious functions into software to attack and mistreat the users. There are four general categories of malicious functionalities. There are the ones that spy on you. They're the ones that are designed to stop you from doing things with the data in your computer, which are digital handcuffs or DRM, digital restrictions management. There are backdoors, and those specifically can be used to attack you. And there is censorship. Sometimes the program even has a universal backdoor, which means that they can forcibly change the software, which means they can put in any malicious functionality later. Well, these can be used against you on behalf of the state. For instance, and not only that, even without an explicit malicious functionality, there's the case of Windows. We know, because it was published in Bloomberg News, that Microsoft shows the NSA bugs in Windows before it fixes them. So if you're using Windows, the developer of that program could be showing someone the bugs to attack you with. So what would you say about any state that uses Windows? It's idiotic. It's basically throwing away national security. So this must be kept in mind. The beginning of computer security is insist on free software. That doesn't guarantee security. Having good security is very difficult. It's a challenging job, even without an artificial obstacle. But proprietary software is an artificial obstacle, and you can't even try to have security. So, in addition, these malicious functionalities are a broader issue than what we usually mean by security. For instance, Apple can remotely extract various kinds of personal data from an iPhone whenever it's connected, basically whenever it's not off or in airplane mode. That is an invasion. It's not what people usually mean when they say computer security, but it's maltreatment. And that's what you're subjecting yourself to if you use such a thing. But the thing is, non-free software nowadays normally has malicious functionality. 30 years ago, it was rare and shocking to discover malicious functionality in a proprietary program. The ethical standards of the industry have changed for the worse, drastically so, to the point where you now must expect that if you think of running a program on your computer and it's proprietary, then it's malware. If you want to see documentation of lots of cases with references in the press, look at gnu.org/proprietary. So basically, you've got to insist on free software. With free software, the users control the program. Now, if you're a programmer, you can exercise that control directly, individually. Of course, most people are not programmers. They're not going to do that, although you could learn to make simple changes if you want to. You know, most people are not carpenters, but you can make some changes in your house. Most people are not mechanics, but you can fix some things in your car. So there, it's not an all or nothing thing, as you well know. But most people are not going to become professional programmers. But if a program is free, all the users are free to participate in groups that then decide what to do. And that means that you have some influence over what the program is going to do by participating in a group that's going to change the program. And you'll be part of the discussion about what to do. Of course, you'll continue to participate in that group as long as you're happy enough with what it does. Otherwise, you may join some other group which has ideas more to your liking. You can also pay a programmer to make the changes you want, just as you can pay a mechanic to do what you want to your car, because it's yours. Anyway, these are reasons why we must insist on free software. But one thing that free software can do is, first of all, the users can make sure it doesn't spy on them. So, to some extent, free software, it blocks one widespread path for surveillance. In addition, encryption experts say that if you want to use encryption, you better make sure that the encryption software is free, because otherwise it will not have been studied publicly and carefully enough by researchers to assure that it really is hard to break. Now, encryption can be used to block some kinds of surveillance. This is the crucial point. Email is actually a rather bad system as far as surveillance is concerned, because they can see who is sending a message to whom. But if the contents are encrypted with a good program like the GNU Privacy Guard, GPG, Snowden has told us that they can't break that. So you actually can have privacy for the contents of your communication.
Fri software er ikke nogen magisk kugle mod overvågning, men det kan hjælpe os rigtig meget. Det vigtigste er, at man selv bestemmer, fortæller et meget varmt talende Richard Stallman. Når man bruger for eksempel Microsoft eller OS X, så er det softwaren, der styrer dig, ikke omvendt. Og så er der sikkerheden. Med et lukket copyright-behæftet softwaresystem, så hænger man på de mennesker, der har designet den her software og deres idé om sikkerhed. Man kommer til at leve på deres nåde. Mange firmaer lægger programmer ind i deres systemer, der enten spionerer mod brugerne eller forhindrer os i at gøre noget, for eksempel at tage kopier af musik. Og så er der bagdøre, både til firmaet bag softwaren og til regeringerne. De bliver brugt imod os af staten. Hvis man tager Windows, så viser de simpelthen NSA, hvilke huller der er i deres styresystemer, før de fikser dem. Hvad skal man synes om et land, der bruger Windows? De er jo idioter. De afleverer jo det hele, siger Richard Stallman. Apple kan hive data ud af din telefon på afstand. Det er en invasion af dit privatliv, og det er det, du udsætter dig selv for, hvis du bruger sådan en. Det nye er, at alle de lukkede systemer nu misbruger os lige så meget, som regulær malware gør. Du er nødt til at insistere på at få fri og åben software, ellers bliver du misbrugt. Selvom du ikke er tømrer, så er der jo nogle små ting, du godt selv kan lave i dit hus. Det kan du ikke med lukket software, kun med åbent. Og det allervigtigste ved åben software er, at man kan sikre sig, at ens computer ikke spionerer mod en. Så på den måde handler det om at sikre sig mod overvågning, siger altså Richard Stallman. Hvis vi nu alle sammen render rundt og bruger fri software og kryptering, hvad skal regeringerne så gøre ved terroristerne? De kan jo også gemme sig.
I have to ask one question. In this world of anonymity and free software, how do we control the bad guys?
Oh, well, you shouldn't think of trying to, quote, control the bad guys, unquote, by watching everyone all the time. That's tyranny. And besides, some of the worst bad guys are working for the state and authorized by the state. When the state gets that much power, there's no check on it. And that becomes the biggest danger. Now, if you... So, of course, those in the state that want more power, they point to a few egregious acts and they say, we should all be terrified of this, so give the state total power over everyone and we'll make sure those things don't happen. Of course, that's not really possible. Most of the time, the state knew about these people, and even if it didn't have total surveillance of everyone, there was a there were grounds to surveil that one person. The problem is that the state knows of so many people in that situation that it can't pay attention enough to them all. Yeah, the computers are tracking them and tracking everybody, but then what? So what happens is the state wants to track everyone. The people in the state want more surveillance power over everybody, and not just for legitimate purposes. So whenever there is some act of violence, they say, this proves you should let us track everything you say and everything you do and who you talk with. But that conclusion is mistaken. And in fact, the amount of violence done by terrorists in the West is so small, it's hardly worth thinking about. It certainly isn't worth sacrificing something very important like human rights to avoid. It's just not a big enough problem. For instance, the biggest terrorist act in the U.S. was the September 2001 attacks, which killed almost 3,000 people. But cars that month killed 4,000 people. And not only that, the cars did it over and over every month since then. Whereas terrorists have never succeeded in doing anything like that again. So which is the big danger? But no one talks about a global war on cars or even a global war on car accidents. There are efforts to reduce the amount of car accidents and the amount of harm that they do, and those are useful activities. And they do some good. I'm told that the rate of harm due to car accidents has gone down. Maybe they're not getting 4,000 people a month. I haven't seen recent figures for the U.S. That 4,000 a month is for the U.S., basically, and it was valid back then. The point is, we're allowing ourselves to overestimate one danger and ignore bigger dangers. You know, if you look at the danger of wars started based on lies, well, W used the September 2001 terrorist attacks as an excuse to start a war. In that war, he killed 4,500 or so Americans, which is more than the terrorists killed. And this is not to mention the hundreds of thousands of Iraqis that his war killed, and more thousands that the subsequent effects of that invasion are continuing to kill now. The existence of the pseudo-Islamic State, I don't want to call it the Islamic State because I don't want to endorse their claims to represent Islam correctly. I call it the pseudo-Islamic State in Syria and Iraq, or PISI. In any case, its existence is a consequence of W's conquest and occupation of Iraq. Well, in this case, the so-called cure was far, far worse than the disease. But even if you just, even if you ignore everybody but Americans, because he was the president of the U.S., so his direct duty, if you ignore our responsibility, responsibilities of being a human being and consider only his responsibilities to the U.S., he killed more Americans than the terrorists did. And this is not unusual. You'll see over and over that this sort of thing happens. So I am not impressed by these arguments that we should give the government more power so it can protect us from occasional acts of violence. And if you'll notice, the acts of violence that they use as excuses are getting smaller and smaller. Now it only takes killing a few people. Well, people get killed in the U.S. In much larger quantities than that. It's a terrible shame for a whole country to lose its freedom because on one occasion a few people are murdered.
Vi er nødt til at holde op med at tro, vi skal kontrollere de onde ved at overvåge alle mennesker hele tiden. Det går ikke. Det er jo et tyranni. De værste terrorister er dem, der arbejder for staten, hævder Stallman, dem, der har lov til at gøre, hvad de vil, og det er rigtig farligt. Giv staten magt over alle, siger de, så får vi styr på det. Men problemet er, at staten har så mange, de skal holde øje med, så det ikke længere giver nogen mening. Staten vil holde øje med alle hele tiden, og hver gang der springer en ny bombe, så siger de, giv os mere overvågning. Men hvis man ser lidt på, hvor lidt terror der faktisk er, er det så værd at ofre menneskerettigheder og vores frihed på det. Terrorangrebet den 11. september stod næsten 3.000 mennesker ihjel, men bare i den samme måned, der døde 4.000 mennesker i biluheld, og det har de gjort lige siden. Hvorfor taler vi ikke om krigen mod bilisme, siger Richard Stallman. Stallman gør opmærksom på, at 4.500 amerikanske soldater døde under krigen flere end ved 11. september, og så taler vi slet ikke om ofrene hos fjenden, over 500.000 døde. Jeg er ikke imponeret over argumenterne for mere overvågning, siger Stallman, især fordi undskyldningerne for at give køb på vores rettigheder bliver dårligere og dårligere. Til gengæld har Stallman håb for fremtiden. Det er et håb med et navn, Snowden.
When you hold your lectures, you generally praise Edward Snowden. How would you describe his contribution to the world?
Edward Snowden is a great hero of the United States. He showed us Americans and everyone else how the U.S. government spies on everyone, how it has fabricated excuses and twisted language to disregard the law while lobbying to weaken the law so that it can, so they can carry out its motto of collect everything. Now we have to take action. He gave us an opportunity. He didn't stop the surveillance, but he gave us a chance to try to stop it. The question is, what do we really need to do? I told you about some kinds of surveillance that free software can protect you from, but it can't protect you from all kinds of surveillance. For instance, cameras. If cameras on the street track people by their faces, it's hard to see how any software that you personally use could protect you from that. Or if they track cars by their license plates, I don't see how you could stop that by running different software. Sometimes, for some kinds of surveillance, the only way to stop it is by organizing politically. For instance, there should be a legal restriction on all license plate cameras, that they must not notice any license plate unless there is a unless it's either invalid or there's an order for surveillance on that particular license plate issued by a court. With this limitation, it becomes legitimate and it will do some good. The point is, we need to limit what information the state can collect about people. Now, for some kinds of surveillance, like spy functionality in your computer, free software can be a protection. But it's not a universal remedy different surveillance systems work differently, and they call for different solutions.
Edward Snowden er en stor helt for USA. Han har vist os, hvordan vores regering spionerede imod alt og alle. Hvordan de ødelægger loven. Han gav os en chance for at gøre noget. Han standsede ikke overvågning, men han gav os en stor chance for at stoppe den. Og her er det ikke nok med free software, siger Richard Stallman. Hvordan skulle man kunne stoppe overvågningskamera, der genkender dig på gaden? Eller automatisk nummerpladegenkendelse? Det kræver i stedet, at man går politisk frem og stiller krav. Vi har brug for en lov imod, at alle nummerplader gemmes. Der skal være dommerkendelse på, resten skal slettes. Så kommer det måske til at virke og gøre en lille smule gavn, siger altså Richard Stallman. Men er han optimist for fremtiden?
One last thing. What are your personal hopes, fears for the future about computing? Do you see, are we going in the right direction now, or are things...
Generally, the world is going in a very bad direction, where digital technology offers attractive bait for a trap that amounts to tyranny.
So you're not a happy optimist?
No, I'm not optimistic by nature. I tend to expect defeat. But what difference does that make? What's important is not what we expect, it's what we do. So I am doing my best to prevent that fate. Why should it matter that my personality is pessimistic?
Betyder det noget som helst, om jeg er pessimistisk af natur, siger Richard Stallman, for det er han. Men hvad nu hvis du, kære lytter, sidder derude nu og tænker, jeg kunne godt tænke mig at installere noget af alt det her free and open software, men samtidig bliver nervøs for, om du kan finde ud af det. Ja, så hør fra manden selv, hvordan man gør.
Well, the GNU operating system, which is typically used with Linux as the kernel, it's GNU plus Linux, has graphical interfaces that anyone can use. You don't have to be a wizard to use it. That's a story that got started in the 1990s. Back then, we didn't have a graphical desktop interface, and you had to type a lot of things on the command line, so yes, you had to know more. But that's not true anymore. What you should do if you want to try it out is visit a user group. In a user group, there are people who like helping other people switch to GNU plus Linux. And they will, for instance, give you a live CD or a live USB. That means you can start your computer running GNU plus Linux without installing that system into your hard disk. So you can try out GNU plus Linux when you feel like it and go back to whatever oppressive proprietary system was installed. And when you feel like it, you can install GNU plus Linux and move permanently. Also, I should point out that you can run some free applications on Windows or Mac OS. So you can run some free software even if you don't run a completely free operating system. But if you want to use GPG for encryption and you want to do it through the convenient graphical interface, look at emailselfdefense.fsf.org. That teaches how to do it with an add-on for Firefox.
Vi ved godt, at det har været en meget nørdet udgave af aflyttet, men vi er nødt til at fortsætte, når vi først er begyndt på det spor, så derfor spurgte vi selvfølgelig også Richard Stallman, hvad for en computer han egentlig bruger.
Would you just for the tech-savvy listeners, could you describe what's your own computer setup?
Oh, well, I have a ThinkPad X60, which I chose because it's possible to replace all the CPU-level software with free software. The BIOS is free, the drivers are free, the system is free, and all the applications are free. In fact, this was the first computer that was ever sold, that you could ever buy from somebody with all free software in it. But now the company is called Gluglug. It's gluglug.org.uk. Nowadays they're selling X200s instead of X60s, but they have the same freedom characteristics.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'm looking forward to see you in Denmark, and have a nice day.
Happy hacking.
We're all right. There's no microphone here.
It takes a little while to realize you're not being overheard.
Or watched. We can look at each other now and not be afraid.
We can say whatever we like to each other.
Og det var altså Richard Stallman, programmør og aktivist, der sluttede vores sidste sommeraflyttet af med et happy hacking. Vi har lidt tid tilbage, så hvorfor ikke tage et kort genhør med endnu en aktivist. Det er den engelske Simon Davies, tidligere formand for Privacy International, nu stifter af Code Red. I marts måned, der besøgte han København, og han har gjort sig en række tanker omkring terror, efterretningstjenester og nysprog.
If the Edward Snowden revelations showed us anything, it's that subversion is part of the fabric of technology and part of the fabric of surveillance to a greater extent than we knew even before. I mean, remember that we were aware, I know I was campaigning on disclosing national security information almost 20 years ago, and there were people working in the field way before me. So, you know, we were aware that huge, vast infrastructures of surveillance were being built. And we knew that they'd infiltrated the telecommunications spectrum, but we had no idea in the internet era, the era of personal computers, that they would infiltrate those channels. Now, that we still haven't got our head wrapped around. I think the average person still doesn't see that as an issue of grave concern, because the average person, I don't think, in fact, most people, average or not, don't look to the dystopia of the future, where this may lead us.
Det vi burde have lært af Edward Snowdens afsløringer er, at efterretningstjenester vildleder og lyver for os for at udvide deres egne beføjelser. Det er ikke fordi det er nyt, det har de altid gjort, men det vi nu har lært, det er, at efterretningstjenesterne er langt inde i vores egne private computer. De fleste af os har ikke fattet det endnu, og slet ikke forstået, hvordan det er med til at gøre vores virkelighed ekstremt skræmmende. Men det er kun begyndelsen, hævder Simon Davies. Der, hvor vi ser de virkelig slemme ting ske, er i sprogets forvandling.
And you see, you have a picture of the dystopia of the future.
I believe the dystopia of the future is where we just lay down and accept the word of authorities that the world is such a dangerous place that individuals have to become effectively not just organs, units to be monitored, but also agents of the state to report back to authorities any aberration, anything that appears to be suspicious, and where language is continually manipulated and truth is manipulated. And we've seen this through the national security agencies of many countries who manipulate the truth, who deceive to entrench their power. That was the true message of George Orwell in 1984. It wasn't the Big Brother TV screens. It wasn't the helicopters. It was that seamless manipulation of the language, manipulation of reality that twists the collective mind of an entire population.
Den fysiske overvågningsstat kan man leve med, men hvis man ikke kan tale om det og bruge de rigtige ord, så er vi for alvor på den. Et ord som terror, det er for eksempel ved at begynde at betyde noget andet, nemlig en udvidelse af efterretningstjenesters beføjelser.
I think one of the gravest examples of language manipulation is where an incident which would have been regarded as a tragedy or a massacre is now a terrorist incident. Everything becomes a terrorist incident. And whenever the word terrorism is used, or the word infiltration, or even worse, recently, the word radicalized, that then empowers the security services and governments to demand more authority, more intrusion capacity. If you look back into the history of these massacres, these shootings and murders, even mass murders, you find very often that the picture is dysfunction operating within society, dysfunctional individuals. You find that the issue is political rather, for example, where right-wing radicals such as those in Norway in 2011, essentially right-wing fanatics, but political fanatics. But those talks, the talk of terrorism and the institutional terrorism that has brought fear to so many people, that's the empowering part of government, and it's what changes the language. This, of course, is before, well, corporations, of course, will manipulate language continually. So so deep inspection of your customers' habits becomes a kind of a customer experience. A know-your-customer process, so it becomes a value added for the consumer, rather than a surveillance mechanism to increase profit.
Når alt pludselig bliver en terrorhændelse, så er det nemt at få flere bevillinger igennem for de mennesker, der gerne vil kontrollere og overvåge os. Det gælder ikke kun her. Private firmaer overvåges også massivt, og kalder det i stedet for at lære os at kende. Men hvad så, når terror bliver konkret, som det blev i København for alt for kort tid siden, og regeringen øjeblikket gik ud og lovede en lille milliard til mere politi og mere overvågning?
The powers that they demand have not been tested and have not been proved efficient in terms of maintaining public safety. Just as a background, this country is instituting increased data retention powers to keep communications information for far longer than is acceptable in other parts of Europe or the world. It is true your defense intelligence services are now seeking powers to put Danish citizens overseas under surveillance without warrant. These continuing increases in powers, your cybersecurity agencies now brought within national security, these things... These developments are entirely unnecessary, and the problem is that in Denmark, as with so many other countries, Australia, Canada, United States, United Kingdom, there is never hardcore evidence produced to justify those additional powers. How do we know, for example, that those powers won't make the problem worse? In other words, where's the risk assessment on those powers? I can tell you now, those risk assessments do not exist. We are supposed to grant these powers on a foundation of blind trust.
Danmark er allerede gået alt for langt angående overvågning og lokning af borgerne i forhold til resten af EU. Og ser man på de nye tiltag, som regeringen vil indføre, så er der én ting, der er slående. Der er ingen, der har lavet en reel risikovurdering af de her tiltag. Vi ved ikke, om de rent faktisk gør tingene værre. Det er faktisk meget sandsynligt, at de gør det. Og de indføres på ren og skær tillid, siger altså Simon Davis. Det er en tillid, som vi bestemt ikke behøver at have, heller ikke når det handler om maskinpistolbevæbnet politi på gaderne.
Well, there's an interesting point to be made about the police with guns on the streets, which I've noticed, that actually fits in with your general security policy. If you notice the police, they're not just carrying one gun, they're carrying two. So is this the Danish approach? You just simply keep increasing the armory in the hope that it's going to make citizens safer. I can tell you that police carrying two loaded weapons, automated or not, does not make me or many other people feel safe. It makes us feel that there is the potential for a maverick attack from within the police, accidental discharge of the weapons. Why would you want two weapons per police unit? That, to me, indicates a mentality which is more is best, without looking at the converse.
Aflyttet er helt forbi for i dag. Jeg hedder Anders Kjærulf, og jeg er naturligvis tilbage i næste uge med mere sprit nyt fra det overvågningssamfund, vi alle sammen bor i. Her, hvor vi ser ind gennem spyttilsølede vinduer i et uendeligt land, der til forveksling ligner et stort Amerika. Et sted, hvor man før kunne sadle sin hest og ride skydende mod solnedgangen, men den Solnedgangen er måske kunstig, blot en rød pixel et sted derinde, så vi må nøjes med at drømme om sandheden i en sjæl og et legeme. Det bliver ikke lige nu, men måske om lidt.
Du lytter til Radio 24/7. Om lidt er der nyheder.